Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
Welcome to episode 3 of the Center of Everywhere, a podcast produced by the Center for Rural Policy and Development, where we discuss and illuminate issues, topics, and policies in rural Minnesota. I'm Kelly Ash, the associate researcher here at the center, and I'm joined by our president and CEO, Julie Tesh. Julie, could you give us a quick, tell our listeners a bit about some of the information we've been posting over the last 3 weeks in regards to COVID-19 pandemic and its impacts to rural Minnesota?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the great thing about being a small organization is it means we can be nimble. And so we have been able to really do some deep diving into the potential effects that COVID-19 can have on aspects of rural Minnesota. So we've been doing pretty much a daily blog, and we have been focusing on different aspects of rural healthcare, whether that's cost, mergers. We've also been looking at economic development and doing some deep dives into the tourism industry and how that might be affected. And then also just looking at and providing information to people on some programs that they can participate in through the Department of Employment and Economic Development, and then also through Extension. So every day we try to have a different topic that really helps out rural Minnesota during this critical time.
Yeah, and today we're gonna dive a bit deeper into our rural healthcare providers' response to the pandemic and discuss the future financial situation they may be facing. And on the phone today, we have Santo Cruz, who is from the St. Cloud area and is a Director of Government and Community Relations and Associate General Counsel for CentraCare Health. We'll talk about CentraCare Health here in just a second. But Santo has past experience working for the state of Minnesota as Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Human Services, Assistant Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Ag, and as an attorney for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and just has a broad understanding of rural Minnesota and how to work to improve policy around rural issues. So it's also worth mentioning, Santo also serves as a board member here at the Center for Rural Policy and Development. And Santo, thanks so much for joining us.
Kelly, thank you so much. You missed probably the most important job on my resume, and that was that I grew up on a dairy farm. And I, you know, whenever you're with the Center for Rural Policy and Development, you're always looking for that street cred that you actually know something about growing up in rural Minnesota. And so most people who have a law degree want you to lead with that. But on this channel, I'm hoping that you say, you know, former dairy farmer. So
that's
thanks
right.
for having me. And thanks for the work.
Santo,
I
had no clue. That's
indeed,
awesome.
Indeed.
Only the best people come from dairy farms like you and I.
That's right. Well, thank you so much for having me. And absolutely, there's been great nimbleness by the center, the research you've done, and you guys have been so engaged on this topic and so quickly that I want to say thank you for having me on the program today, but also just for your leadership and one, finding those narratives, finding those issues, and getting answers for your listeners and for the members of folks who are tuned into what you have to offer. There's a lot of really, 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 really rich resources on your website.
Thanks, Santo. And I guess, you know, kind of tagging on that note, you know, we've been hearing in the media lately about the debate over the different models being used to predict the cases and deaths and when the peak will hit and which model is better. But regardless of which model is being used, there's still statewide estimates. And, you know, here at the center, we kind of take pride in trying to shine a lens focused on rural Minnesota. And since CentraCare, the organization you work for, has a large network of providers covering metropolitan and then also our most rural areas in the state, can you provide us a glimpse into how your hospital system uses these models for different regions and how they might look a little bit different?
Yeah, so as you said, there's a number of different models out there. And as I'm sure you've all heard the analogy, it's a little bit like weather forecasting models. Some are better at, you know, predicting when a storm will arrive. Others are better at predicting how intense that storm will be. And so we're trying to blend the benefit of the different models that are out there. The one that's probably most discussed is what's called the IHME model out of Washington. And that one looks at a 4-month time horizon. And that has been proven, or thus far been proven, to be rather accurate on the mortality rate. However, when you're talking about preparing for things over the long run, more than just a 4-month time horizon, you really need to have a model that seeks out that 12-month potentiality. And so we feed our specific data, our local rural Minnesota data, into a model that provides that type of year-long forecasting. And so by kind of looking at both of those and blending that viewpoint, we feel like we have the benefit of knowing, okay, how intense could this storm be? And then also with our own local data fed into that our model, you know, when will that arrive?
Can you provide us a little bit of glimpse of the differences you see in the virus spreading and its intensity? Are there differences between rural areas and metropolitan areas?
You know, the driver has really been about, you know, congregate settings. You know, those have been, you know, the quote unquote tinderboxes of spread, whether that be in a long-term care facility or very sadly down in your neck of the woods, either the Smithfield plant, pork plant in South Dakota, or the JBS in Worthington. So wherever you have folks who are in, you know, confined spaces and close contact for prolonged periods of time, you're going to find that the virus does very efficient transmission in that environment. And that's really what the social distancing measures are all about, is trying to get that advantage back on the human side of the equation, not the virus side of the equation, when it comes to the settings that people are in.
So, you know, we hear a lot about when the cases may peak, and, you know, it may come in waves, and you're kind of hearing different ways in which this the virus might spread. I'm curious, do you potentially see different peaks where, you know, we might talk about a statewide peak being in a high population area, particularly metropolitan areas where it'd be hitting the hardest, versus when it may peak, let's say in northern Minnesota, people start traveling again? You know, is that discussed at all? Is that at all assumed in the models?
Yes, that's a really good point. There is absolutely I wouldn't say an accounting for in terms of that the models are able to predict what these waves will look like, but I would say an accounting for in that it is very much expected that this will come in waves, because as the social distancing and the measures that we are currently experiencing, and don't get me wrong, these are major sacrifices that many people are making in order to achieve this kind of suppression of the peak. As that starts to loosen up and we get more PPE for providers to be able to treat people, we have more ventilators, our capacity grows to treat folks. Well, as those things relax, then people are going to be out more. Transmission will likely pick up again. And then we'll need to either react to that with new measures, modified measures, or the like. But you're absolutely right. It's very, very likely that this will have multiple kind of undulating peaks as time goes on.
And there is some suspicion that that might be different in rural areas versus metropolitan areas as far as when it might peak or where they might happen and occur, kind of these, like you said, tinderbox style.
Absolutely. So, you know, obviously where you have dispersed populations, you kind of have social distancing to an extent kind of built into that community. However, where there's the exception to that, like a processing plant or like a long-term care facility or schools, or you name it, you're going to find that if transmission gets into that particular setting, it's going to behave the same way there as it would in the metro area. So I do think that just given the number of people that are in, you know, in Minnesota, I think we're about 80-20, about 80% of the population lives in the metro area, and the rest of the population is dispersed throughout rural and greater Minnesota. And I think you'll probably see that there will be kind of these hot spots, like you saw in Martin County a couple of weeks ago, where, you know, for one reason or another, either due to setting or through circumstances, it starts to kind of concentrate in a rural area. But I do think that in general, those will be much more kind of, as you say, kind of popping up or dispersed and not as connected as in the metro area, where because you have so many more people in such a smaller amount of geographic space. Now, granted, it's all about the social distancing, but in general, I think that you see the predominance of the cases right now are certainly in the metro area. If you look at where we were at the very beginning till present day, the majority of the cases have come from the seven county metro, but eventually I think you can check my numbers on this, but I think 70 of the 87 counties have their first case or have had their first case. So eventually it will get to every county. And quite frankly, it probably is already there given the lack of testing that we currently have.
Okay. So Santo, you and I and the Center for Rural Policy had a conversation a couple weeks ago where you kind of enlightened us on how, you know, CentraCare has kind of been preparing, and a lot of hospitals around the state have been preparing for this potential pandemic at the time since January. Could you, you know, give our listeners a little bit of a glimpse in how preparations happen? And also, what are there any different roles that maybe the larger hospitals play versus some of your smaller clinics in rural areas or even some of the more rural hospitals in your system play and how that looks?
Yeah, so CentraCare, along with several other organizations around the state, when we saw the information coming out of Wuhan, China around a novel coronavirus, institute what's called an incident command structure. And really what that is just pulling people out of their daily tasks and forming a decision-making matrix or decision-making kind of org chart that doesn't follow the business as usual. Things are much more rapid. Meetings are virtually every day, sometimes twice a day. And anything that has to do with the crisis at hand is run through that decision-making process, which is much, much more rapid than the business as usual model, where you're really trying to say, okay, what's going to happen, you know, in the next 24 hours rather than what's going to happen over the next, you know, quarter or the like over the year. So that decision-making structure helps solve a lot of initial problems, which is identifying what are the things that we're going to need. And as you're aware, and it has come out in the news so much, you know, obviously there's the people that we need, the frontline staff and the need to protect them. And that really drove the early decision that CentraCare made prior to the state mandating it of winding down its elective surgeries. That wasn't done because the environment needed to be protected. That was done so that we could preserve the protective equipment that gets used up in that environment. So when you go in to get a knee replacement, those folks are using a lot of the same protective equipment that we would use in identifying or treating COVID patients. And because of the global nature of the strand supply chain, that was really essential to be able to do that. So there's kind of the equipment side of things, the people side of things, and of course that gets to ventilators. And then finally, I would say the ICU beds themselves, which drives a little bit of the answer to your question around how do different facilities get used in terms of what type of hospital and metro partners and rural partners. Certainly, every hospital is involved. It's absolutely an all hands on deck across the state. So, you know, not just CentraCare, but I've talked to virtually every hospital system and community hospitals that are part of the Minnesota Hospital Association. Every single day, we have a government relations officer contact call every day. And we hear about the engagement issues that's going on. And it has been a tremendous response in that regard. However, there is a difference between an ICU bed and a regular hospital bed. And so the intensive care unit really does have a lot of things going for it once someone would need that critical care. And in order to be able to provide that level of care, there are some critical access hospitals that probably will be able to do, and a critical access hospital for your listeners is a predominant we have in rural Minnesota. These are 25 bed or less hospitals that are in the community. They participate in a federal program that allows them to basically sustain themselves in a unique way so that people do have access to a certain number of services, even in rural Minnesota. And Minnesota really does have, you know, per capita, some of the most critical access hospitals, just about any other state in the country. I think Iowa might be right up there with us. Mm-hmm. So they're a tremendous asset for rural folks. However, when it does come to the ICU bed, we do really have to look at what are those centers that can really handle that. Certainly where I work at the St. Cloud Hospital, we're a tertiary care facility, so we have a kind of an ICU unit, and we can expand that through a number of different measures that we can take. So we do have that dichotomy in terms of we will be, you know, a place that accepts patients, and not every critical access hospital will, but each one will play a role in both identifying, screening, and transporting folks who do come down with the disease.
And I imagine those critical access hospitals, that's kind of the first stop for anybody that's feeling symptoms in our more rural areas of the state is kind of their local hospital. And
that's exactly right.
Okay.
That's exactly right.
Now, you know, before COVID-19 hit, you know, kind of hit us hard, the Center for Rural Policy, we were actually doing some healthcare research looking at some of the impacts of mergers and acquisitions and healthcare institutions across the state, what that means for access. And you know, we kind of identified that the pressures put on hospitals regarding this kind of new payment scheme. And if you want more information about that, you can check it out on our website. But, you know, hospitals are getting more and more pressure to try to reduce their costs, thus trying to reduce prices, while at the same time increase quality. And then, you know, for our smaller rural hospitals, they have this double whammy of trying to meet these, trying to be more efficient with less volume as far as patients coming through their hospitals. And now with the COVID-19 pandemic hitting, we've taken away all the elective surgeries, and a lot of the services are way down because people are either afraid to go to the hospital or they're just not being offered in general, which has really cut into the revenue streams for a lot of our healthcare providers across the state. So it's definitely seemed to be a pretty significant sacrifice in terms of revenue during this pandemic among our hospitals and healthcare providers. I guess from you, you know, from CentraCare standpoint, where you have larger hospitals, smaller hospitals, clinics, and all kinds of healthcare providers in your system, are you seeing any type of organization that's weathering this a little bit better, and any concerns you have kind of going over the next 6 months to a year after we get through this? What are you guys seeing from a financial standpoint?
So, thanks for the question, because I think it gives us a chance to highlight for folks something that's so important. You know, I think that this virus and this crisis has really uncovered some unique truths that that maybe we knew in concept but didn't fully appreciate. I would say maybe chief among them for your listeners is just outside of healthcare is the importance of the food supply and the nobility of work that involves a tractor or sweat or what typically gets referred to as blue collar work, truck drivers and you name it. I think that this pandemic has really uncovered the nobility of that work and how we all maybe didn't realize it or didn't appreciate it before, but we are all structurally dependent upon that set of labor, those people who are called to that way of life. I would say in a not similar, because I wouldn't want to associate the medical profession's nobility with the food supply nobility. We need both. But quite frankly, one of the truths that was uncovered through this pandemic was that really healthcare is cross-subsidized off of surgical procedures. And that's through a series of longstanding policy decisions that have been made both in the Medicare, Medicaid, and commercial insurance markets, where the thing that really brings in the margin or the revenue is not really your core business, so to speak. You saw this also with the restaurants. You know, they allowed for folks to be able to basically be kind of pickup sites for restaurants. And they quickly had to realize that they had to allow for people to sell alcohol because, again, the margin in that business is in the drinks. Right. The margin in healthcare is in the surgical procedures. And when you shut that off, everything suffers because everything is cross-subsidized by it. Now, I think that to your more specific question, I've not really seen any healthcare system across the country that isn't experiencing what we are. And that is a very sobering outlook financially in order to sustain our mission. And in Minnesota, we have the benefit of having, in terms of hospitals, no for-profit hospitals. What that means is that, you know, every hospital in Minnesota is a not-for-profit. Does that mean that the prices are significantly different, or somehow people aren't shocked by their bill when they get it from a nonprofit hospital? No, it doesn't. What it means is that money that does come in is used to cross-subsidize other services to create a system of healthcare that could be mental health care, that could be children's pediatrics, could be any number of things. But instead of in the for-profit model where those profits go directly to shareholders or owners in the company. So for our stake, we're looking at this and saying, how do we continue to serve our mission? Well, we are continuing to see less coming in the front door, and ever more dollars going out the back door in terms of costs. Right now, we are spending on average 6 times more than we would normally spend for all of the same supplies that we would have needed, you know, anytime before this pandemic. And that's largely been through just an increase in demand and a shortage of supply globally. So the prices are really through the roof for us in this time. But, you know, we're putting that money out there because it's to protect our patients and to protect our workforce. And there's really no compromising in that. So the federal government has stepped up with some of their part of the CARES Act. The state government has stepped up and provided some relief. But there's going to be, particularly for rural hospitals, there is going to need to be ongoing support or creative solutions to get out of the hole that we're currently digging.
Moving forward, what do you feel has hospitals in general or healthcare provider systems in general discussed any strategies to try and shore up some of their financial situation? You know, what kinds of solutions might there be just within the hospital systems themselves? I mean, we've been seeing workers getting furloughed and laid off within services that aren't being used right now. Are there other strategies being discussed?
You know, there's tons of strategies that are being discussed in terms of what you can do. At CentraCare, when this initially came out, we made the decision to not lay off for a period of 2 months. So, and that's still going on now, where we figured there was just so much uncertainty currently. And I think that we're all experiencing this on a human level. There was so much uncertainty about what was going to happen and how that our CEO made the decision that we were going to make a commitment to our workforce that if you're going to be furloughed, you were still going to be paid so long as you were willing to go into a labor pool where you could be reassigned. And we've seen tremendous response and a lot of gratitude from our workforce, particularly on that, as we've seen, you know, many, many difficult decisions being made around the state. Now, once that 2 month period is over, will we have to make additional adjustments? No doubt. What will they look like? Those are in discussions right now, but absolutely the goal is always to have as little impact on the folks who we need to focus on this surge, on this crisis, on their communities, on our loved ones as possible. And that is a real, real tension when you're looking at, you know, the as you say, the surgical procedures not being done, which is normally how things cash flow.
What kind of risk do you feel like our smaller healthcare providers in rural areas are facing financially and as far as maybe services being lost or even some closures?
You know, it's this is something that is very similar to agriculture that your listeners will fully understand, and that's scale. It's difficult to do healthcare at a smaller scale than to scale up, and particularly when margins are thin for hospitals, and they are. You know, for leading into this crisis, it wasn't like rural hospitals were doing all that great to begin with, and so as they saw declining margins and declining services in rural areas, this was kind of a 1-2 punch in terms of they had to take on this crisis not from a position of strength. So in terms of looking forward, how do they get out of that situation? I think there'll definitely have to be some relief from the federal government if we're really going to preserve the essential infrastructure that's currently there. Or there's going to be just so many more tragic circumstances for rural Minnesota to really have to sustain the, I would say, almost a triple blow. As you know, and as your listeners know, agriculture was in a very, very vulnerable state before this came about. And now, while food prices are strong, processing is down due to situations. Global trade has been significantly challenged. The prices on a lot of these commodities has started to drop. I've been hearing stories of, you know, potential milk dumping that'll be coming to the state. It's certainly happening in other parts of the country. And we need to find a way to preserve the infrastructure and the way of life that rural Minnesota offers. And that's what I love about the Center for Rural Policy and Development is they don't flinch. You guys don't flinch at the reality of the challenges faced by rural Minnesota, but you do try and find unique solutions and conversations to be part of to influence the things that we're going to need to preserve this way of life. And healthcare is part of that. People's livelihoods is part of that, and agriculture is part of that, because it will be so much more difficult and almost impossible to replace if we lose it because of this crisis. So And to answer your question, I think there's going to have to be some significant relief and accommodation from the federal and state government for agribusiness, for healthcare, and for rural areas in general.
So Santo, that was kind of the last question I had for you, but I really feel like we got to try and end, you know, on a positive note, if possible. Are you seeing any light at the end of the tunnel, or anything positive?
Well, I appreciate that, and I will tell you that there are many positive things. You know, I can't tell you the number of hand sewn masks that have been delivered to our hospitals. I can't tell you how many folks have offered to bring food or take care of loved ones. And you know, rural Minnesota has just been a wonderful place to grow up and for me to raise my own children, largely because of the people. And the people aren't changing. They're rising to the occasion. They're rising to the challenge and rising to the occasion. And so I would say if you're looking for a positive note, you really have to look no further than your friends and family during these circumstances and watching the things that they're all doing. We're certainly seeing them at CentraCare. We have nurses, quite frankly, who have asked to be furloughed, not for financial reasons, but because they actually want to go help out in hotspots around the country. And so when you look at that type of response to say, you know what, we don't have the surge here yet. Is there something I could do to go serve people around the country who do need my services? It humbles you in a way that it makes you say, what can I do and what more could I do? And I think that, you know, this cliche of we're all in this together has certainly been repeated again and again. But it's one of those cliches that has has at least the benefit of being true, both in practicality, but then also just inspiration-wise. You just see so many folks who are doing so much to serve the folks that they're around. And I'm sure you see it in your local communities. I know I see it in mine. And so whenever I'm looking for inspiration, you know, checking with a neighbor or a loved one, making sure that folks have a way to get their groceries or the fuel they need, is really something that has been inspiring to me both at work and at home. And I hope that your listeners see those examples all throughout rural Minnesota, as I trust they do.
Thanks a lot, Santo. Really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much, and thanks for all your work.
All right. This has been episode 3 here at the Center of Everywhere for the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Hope you enjoyed this episode and have a great week.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.